Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, surrounded by the gang here, Jacob, Simon, Mike, John, and Jack. A little later, we're going to be speaking with some folks from Enbridge to talk about Line 5. But John, while I was gone on vacation, looks like we decided to pass the time with another Deno insider poll, and it looks like the folks who were in town and not joining me in Florida didn't have a lot to do. We had a ton of participants for that thing.
We had a ton of participants, which was nice. I also think it turned up the participation rate because we teased it with the whole governor's question, who was going to win the gubernatorial contest if it were held today, Bill Schuette or Gretchen Whitmer. And I think that if people weren't, oh, there's nothing going on, I can play.
Well, why did you guys just decide to do Whitmer versus Schuette?
Oh, I think it's obviously she's clearly the strong Democrat in the field right now, the one with the biggest name ID. He's clearly one of the biggest in terms of the Republican side. I just thought it would be interesting to see those particular candidates lined up and see what our readers and insiders thought about it.
Well, because initially when I looked at it, I thought, well, gee, shouldn't we have the whole field? But the more you think about it, the reason we ask this question is to take the temperature of what's going on right now.
Right. And I think what you're seeing is the insider community is realizing the fact that 2018 is probably going to be a Democratic year. It usually is after the other party wins the presidency. You've got that. You've got the end of an eight-year Republican gubernatorial reign here, so that always creates a little bit of a swing. So I think that 68.9 or 70% figure we found is probably supportable just based on history.
Whitmer versus Schuette, 70% believe that Whitmer would beat Schuette if the election were held today. Jack, what did you make of that?
Well, to be honest with you, I think if 2018 isn't a good Democratic year, they better really start worrying, especially in Michigan, after the 8 years of complete Republican control, Rick Snyder leaving, what's going on in D.C. I think it's the natural position to take right now. It kind of reminds me of my NCAA brackets, which I never did, but somebody asked, who do you pick off the top of your head if you don't know that much about it? North Carolina, which was the only one I said. And by gosh, sometimes that generic, logical answer that you give at that point in time ends up being the right one.
John, you also asked some other things in the poll. What else did we ask folks?
Always been a lot of talk about this road funding package that was passed in 2015 and how long it was going to take to ramp up to the promised $1.2 billion in annual new road funding. Spring, we're all getting jarred as we drive downtown to work. So I asked what the likelihood is that the state will ever get to that $1.2 billion figure that's been promised. And surprisingly, again, almost 68% said, no, I don't think we're going to actually get there.
And you know what? That reminded me of when Tim Skubick and myself and who else did we have? We had Zach from Gongwer and Lindsay from Bridge Magazine in front of the County Road Association. And they asked this crowd, how many of you folks, and these are all county road officials, how many of you actually believe we're going to get the $1.2 billion because the legislature is going to appropriate the other $600 million out of the general fund? And not a single hand went up. And this was a room of, I would say, a few hundred county road officials. They don't believe this is going to happen. And clearly, the insiders here in Lansing don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I mean, look, we've already got a big push towards some kind of tax cut before we've even begin to ramp up what we've got to commit to meeting that goal. There's a lot of reason to doubt it's actually going to happen. I mean, I think the lawmakers are getting diverted right now with a new bright, shiny object in the form of a tax cut. So that's going to take their attention away from meeting that commitment.
I think it signals a real change, too, if you stop and think about it. During that whole decade of talking about how are we going to get money for roads, et cetera, there was a real, I felt, insider kind of over-optimism that, they'll get it this way, they'll get it that way, sooner or later we'll get it. And maybe after that experience and how that turned out, that I think there's a real change of perspective in terms of turning from optimistic on that to, obviously, based on the poll, to some pessimism about it.
Talking about bright, shiny objects, Simon, we're going to be writing today about the Cindy Gamrat. And I didn't tell you I was going to spring this on you, but I just find this really interesting just to give our listeners some perspectives that Cindy Gamrat has not been Todd Corser-like with her suits in claiming what happened to her was unjust until now. And before, it was Todd Corser who was spouting the conspiracy theory that folks were working against them to try and shove them out of office. Her prior suit was taking a completely different tack. She was saying that she was deprived due process during the special committee hearing, that she was basically promised that if she signed some admission letter, that the worst off she was going to get was censure. She signed the document, and then in the end, they expelled her anyway. Now she is casting the big, wide net over her staff, her husband, the folks that worked with her husband, and the speaker and his staff, that they all were in cahoots to get her out of office. What are you making out as you're reading all this?
Well, I mean, I think that it is very much something like out of the playbook of Todd Corser. This is, I mean, he has alleged that there is recordings that that have not been revealed to him and his attorney about, you know, coordination between the speaker's office and other officials, you know, essentially working to get them out of office. And this is essentially what Cindy Gamrat is alleging in her lawsuit now, except that she's bringing in her now soon-to-be ex-husband, Joe Gamrat, into it, saying that he worked with Corser and Gamrat's own aides to sort of build the case against the two representatives.
I find the suit interesting in that it keeps this whole story alive, for better or for worse, in this town. The problem that she's going to run into is the proof that showed that she really got the screw job from all these folks working against her. I mean, where is the smoking gun that shows that they were all in cahoots to try and push her out of office? The other is that it's as if she has no culpability in this scheme at all, which I think is also a major problem. What I am interested in seeing what happens is this wiretapping situation, because I'd like to see what kind of proof that she has that her staff and Joe Gamrat were wiretapping her, and then if there's anything that can come out of that as far as any relief on her, because I think it's pretty clear that her staff and Joe were working together. Whether that equates to any type of relief from a judicial sense, I'm kind of curious. I'm holding out on that one.
Yeah, the thing is that Michigan, at least loosely, is legally a one-party state when it comes to recording, meaning that if you are a party to the conversation, you can record the conversation and you don't have to notify the other party, and you cannot be accused of wiretapping or eavesdropping. Todd Corser has maintained that his office was bugged or that he was monitored in some way that he was not aware of, and that, you know, someone was not a party to that. And assistant attorneys general have said, you're welcome to look at all the evidence in our criminal case against you, like, you won't find anything of this. But he believes that there was something placed on his computer that was recording his office activities. And this is essentially what Cindy Gamrat is alleging, is that there was wiretapping and eavesdropping devices that she was not aware of. But as to what they would be, that is something that is very much a mystery.
Well, and we'll see what happens as this works through the process. I think it's pretty clear, though, now that she is gainfully employed, because now she can hire legal counsel to push this forward, whereas she couldn't before. All right, last thing I want to touch on is the Nestle plant expansion. Now, Mike, I'm going to have you go up to Ferris this week to find out what's going on as far as the public reaction to Nestle wanting to pump more water out of the ground. Why is this a big issue from a statewide perspective?
Water issues in Flint and Detroit, access to water has been hot on people's minds. And in the case of Nestle, they're able to draw on from their own well. It's their well. They've been able to draw 250 gallons every minute out of the ground, and they want to increase that up to 400 gallons per minute. That's really a lot of water, if you think about it, and they're paying fees for it. When you turn on your faucet at home, you have to pay a cubic foot charge. I think a number of people are looking at the fairness of it. They have access to all this water, and if you're a city resident, and especially in Flint and in Detroit, you're paying heavy rates for for the water coming to your house.
This is almost precedent-setting, Jacob, in the sense that it renews a discussion in, are we going to make Nestle and then conceivably other people who pump water out of the ground for public sale charge something more than what we're charging Nestle, which is what, $200?
Yeah, from what I read, I think that's the right amount. Yeah, so that's one of the issues. I think the two issues I've been seeing from this is, yeah, that issue in terms of how much should Nestle pay or anyone that gets this kind of permit pay for such a substantial use of water, and kind of what that looks like in terms of the relationship with the state with business in terms of how they're treated. And I think that's certainly a way that opponents are looking at this. And then, of course, the other issue, again, is the environmental impact. Anytime you're talking about water withdrawal, there's going to be a lot of talk about how does this affect the other water systems around the aquifer itself, and what that's going to do to those water systems and the life that it's supported by.
And you mentioned something, Simon, about the amount of water that it takes to make the plastic and to transport bottled water. That's not something that I've really thought of much.
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue that really hits home for environmentalists and people who are water-minded with conservation. And I think what's also important is that if you look at this in the context of our national political climate, they're making this move at the, you know, basically with a fledgling administration that has taken a lot of steps to incite and incense environmentalists almost at every turn. Much of what they've done with the EPA and its new administrator have been with the aim of undoing a lot of the regulatory, what they viewed as regulatory overreach from the previous administration. So as a result, a lot of these people who are grassroots and local level environmental activists are now looking to cities and looking to states to step in and cover the ground that they believe that they've lost under the Trump administration. Well, and as a result, I think that this is going to really, that this has the potential to mobilize a lot more people.
I think this also has the potential to be a money generator for the state, Jack.
Well, if it plays out the right way, it could be. You do have this question of charging an awfully minimal amount for the uses of these resources.
For sale.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I always am bothered by these issues because I don't know what the amounts really mean. When you say 450 gallons, 300 gallons, et cetera, I like to know, how much is that in a day? Is that enough to fill an average municipal pool for a day? How much is that over the course of a month? I like some bigger thing to compare it to so I actually have some context to know how much are they really withdrawing. And these things seem to almost never come down to that kind of a comparison so that you really know exactly what they're talking about.
I have a feeling that we're going to be talking a lot about Nestle water and spring water going forward as the DEQ works their way through this permit process, and we'll be paying attention to your coverage on that, Mike. All right, with that, we're going to touch on another important environmental issue with the folks from Enbridge. Joining us now for the podcast is Jason Mancham. He's a spokesperson, community engagement strategist with Enbridge. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Obviously, Line 5 has been a huge subject in this city for a few years now. Give our listeners an update as to where we are right now with the line. Any chance that we're going to maybe replace it or spruce it up or do anything to alter it in any way?
You know, Line 5 is part of our overall energy infrastructure in Michigan. Many of your listeners may know we have four crude oil pipelines in the state, Line 5 being the first of those to be installed. And Line 5 carries light crude oil and natural gas liquids into and through the state. There is a lot of talk about the safety and operational reliability of Line 5. And over the last couple of years, we have worked significantly with the state of Michigan and with local and county municipalities to be able to answer questions and assure everyone that Line 5 is safe. So where we are today, Line 5, of course, is operating safely as it has for the last 60-plus years. But we are working with the state and their Pipeline Safety Advisory Board, which is set up through the task force, on two independent third-party studies. One of those would be a risk analysis that the state is looking at from the perspective of if there were a release on Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac, what would be the worst-case scenario? What is the risk? Not just from a volume-out perspective, but also from an economic, business, tourism perspective, wildlife, etc. That is expected to be done, I hear, in June. The second study is an alternatives analysis. And that really gets, I think, to the origin of your question, is that a third party is looking at, are there any better alternatives to Line 5 as it exists today? So what this third party is tasked with is looking at either a replacement line, as you mentioned, looking at existing pipeline infrastructure, looking at other travel mechanisms outside of a pipeline, say a barge, a truck, a rail. And then it's also looking at what they call status quo, which is simply saying, is Line 5 in its existing state the best method of transport? Likewise, I understand that that report is due sometime in the month of June. And, you know, when those reports are released, we'll be working again with the state and all of our key community stakeholders throughout Michigan on next steps.
A quick question for you. The recent TIM report that came out suggested that there would be an ultrasonic scan of the 4-mile pipeline. The original easement that was given to Lakehead Pipeline Company required an X-ray of every joint in the pipeline. Given the fact that this pipeline was laid in 1953, only 7 years after they really started the technology of undersea pipelines to begin with, is there any plans to do an ultrasonic scan? Is there any plans to do kind of a more high-tech scan of the entire structure?
You know, Line 5 originally was constructed and engineered to stand the test of time. It was an engineering marvel, you know, in 1953. When you look at the companies who we worked with to construct and engineer it, all these years later in 2017, it still is an engineering marvel because there's nothing like it in our system or, quite frankly, in the world. And that's because it was designed specifically to be in the Straits of Mackinac, which is to say in a 4.5 or so mile stretch of water, cold, fresh water, and at depths of up to 250 feet. So it's very specific to that location. You know, with that, we have been testing the line and inspecting it routinely since its origin. In fact, today, when you look at what we do, it's much more frequently than the minimum requirements that we're regulated to inspect the line with. And we use a multitude of tools to inspect it. Different tools, quite simply, look for different things on the line. We can look for such things as dents, cracks, buckles, corrosion. We can look at the welds. We can look at the integrity of the line up and down, not just at the straits, but elsewhere. We even now have employed tools that are like smart balls. They're actually some balls that go into the line. In our other inspection tools, you may have heard the term called smart pigs, which is really like a pipeline inspection gadget. Those tools are essentially like mini MRI machines using the latest you find in healthcare. And they're finding things right down to the millimeter that are microscopic to the human eye.
So you really don't need to do what he's talking about.
Well, really the essence of this is, you know, there is no one test or one way to inspect a pipeline. You have to do it in a myriad of ways, multiple layers of inspections. You know, on top of all of these interior tools we're talking about, we inspect the outside with underwater vehicles, both remote controlled and autonomous, and then we have divers, you know, that go down at least every other summer. So the picture I'm making is when you have that many different types of tests and tools running through the line, looking at all different sorts of potential problems, you get a very clear picture, you know, as to how this line looks over time, because you're layering inspection data over the historical data, and you can start to see changes even as they pop up microscopically. And that would warrant the decision being made if further inspection is needed, you know, if we need to send some team down to have a further look, or, you know, if repairs or replacement is needed. But again, that's one area I can say where technology over the time since 1953 has vastly improved our ability to maintain that line safely because of the things we can do now with the tools we couldn't do even 5 or 10 years ago.
So are you saying then shutting down the line so you can run something through it like what John's talking about? It doesn't sound like that's absolutely necessary considering the technology that you have right now. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, the tools that we have now actually allow us to test the line while it's still operational. In fact, the product, the crude oil, pushes the tools through the line. I will mention there are a couple of additional inspections that will be coming up this year. One, and you may have heard of this, is a hydro test or a hydrostatic test. A hydrostatic test, quite simply, is, you know, purging the line or that segment of line from its product, cleaning it on the inside with a tool, and then pressurizing it with water and running very high-pressured water through the line to test for any leaks.
How high pressure did you get on that? Because the operating pressure, I think in the easement, said 600 pounds per square inch.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be tested up to 1,700 pounds, so I was wondering how you're going to take it.
Great question. You know, at the Straits of Mackinac, in particular, the operating pressure is about its lowest point in the entire length of that line. And it's done that way on purpose. If you look at it over the last couple of years, historically on average, you know, we're right around 100 pounds per square inch, or PSI, give or take, but right around 100. Now, how that compares, the line we know can safely run up to 600 pounds per square inch. That's our maximum allowable operating pressure, 600. We are going to be testing it this summer at the original hydro test levels from the 1950s, and that is 1,200 PSI. So double our maximum allowable, but you can see virtually about 12 times higher than it actually operates from a day-to-day basis.
Now, were you guys running these tests on the line on the Kalamazoo River before that had an accident?
Yeah, all of our pipelines, Line 5, Line 6B, and across our entire system, have our pipeline inspection tools, those smart pigs, run through them on a regular recurring basis.
So what happened there?
Yep, a great question. A couple of things. First of all, I'll say, you know, Line 5 in particular is our most inspected pipeline in the entire company. We have more than 10,000 miles of crude oil pipelines here in North America, and Line 5 is the most inspected. But I mentioned before a lot of the technology changes in the last 5 or 10 years. The smart pigs are the tools that we're running today, far more advanced than they were even 7 years ago when we experienced Marshall. And so you look at that and you look at other procedures now that we're following, you know, what it does really, between the technology and the process improvements we're making, it minimizes or mitigates the risk of ever having a potential leak. And quite frankly, you know, that's the difference today. It's additional inspections looking for different sorts of problems or abnormalities than before, and improving our processes, procedures, and training of our personnel.
So you learned from the Kalamazoo River and now are applying that to what we're doing with Line 5 of the Mackinac.
Yeah, there's no question. The event that took place on the Kalamazoo River was one of the darkest days we've ever experienced as a company. But at the end of the day, what that's done is it's made us a safer company everywhere we operate, Line 5 included.
Jason, you mentioned the work that the state advisory board is doing on the alternative report, on the alternatives analysis. When that comes out, it's finalized. Are you guys considering that kind of the final word on what should be done alternatively, if anything, with the Line 5 pipeline?
Well, again, everything that's been done has been a process so far. So if you go back to, 2014, I believe it was, that's when the task force was started by Governor Snyder. Of course, that task force, after a year, led to 13 recommendations about our energy infrastructure, four of which were specific to Enbridge Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac. So out of those recommendations, of course, came this Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. And as you all know, they've been working diligently on those two specific recommendations now, risk and alternatives, as you mentioned. So once these reports are completed in the summertime, I would expect then that the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board would take those reports and work with the task force, the governor, and the attorney general on any potential next steps, because what they are, again, are recommendations. Our plan, quite simply at this point, is to continue to work with the state of Michigan on any potential plans going forward based out of those reports. You know, we don't know yet what they're going to say, but I can tell you that we will be working jointly with them, regardless of what the reports indicate.
And follow up on that then. So based on that, would the company accept the results of the alternative report if it's anything but the status quo?
You know, we'd have to look to see what the alternative is, and also, and this is very important, why it's stating that specific or that particular alternative. You know, it's too early in the game right now without seeing any of the findings to speculate as to what they would say, and again, why they would say it. I just know that from a company perspective, we have and will continue to do everything we can to not only deliver the crucial energy that we need, but also to do it in such a way to protect the Great Lakes and all of our inland water crossings. And that's paramount. So regardless of what the alternative says and why it's indicated, we have to work together to protect those natural resources.
It seems that recently much of the work Enbridge has been doing has been to demonstrate how minimal the risk is and to mitigate it as much as possible. What would you say, though, for those individuals, especially environmental activists, who argue that any risk at all is too great?
You know, we have seen that question before. And really, you know, you have to look at the alternative, meaning if the infrastructure didn't exist for any reason, how would you get the crude oil into the state? How would you get the natural gas liquids, which becomes propane for many of us? How would that get into the state and serve all of us? What would happen if it couldn't get to us, or it couldn't get to us very economically? And the greatest example I can think of right now is a few winters ago, when we had the real harsh polar vortex winter. You may recall there is a propane shortage here in Michigan, which simply meant Line 5 couldn't deliver the needed natural gas liquid, in particular for the Upper Peninsula. And we all know what happened to the price of propane that year. It skyrocketed, making it, quite frankly, unaffordable for many people there. And that's just with a reduced amount of the energy. And so, again, you have to look at a sustainable delivery option where you can safely and reliably deliver the energy, because we know we use it and we know we need it. But you have to do it in an environmentally safe way. And that really is the balance that Enbridge has been doing and striving for its 60-plus year history and will continue to do going forward. It's not an option of choosing environment over energy. It's making sure you have a sustainable model that you can have both.
One of the recent issues that kind of flared up in the last month or so was this question about the wrap, I guess it has glass content in it. It was required in the original easement. Why is that not an issue where it's coming apart? And I guess, can you speak a little bit to that from Enbridge's perspective?
Sure. So Line 5 has a coating on it that is, it was the predominant coating from that era in the 1950s. And it is a coal tar coating that was applied, of course, at the steel mill. Now, historically, pipelines in that era have held up extraordinarily well. All across North America, if you look, the maintenance and repair work on pipelines that vintage with that coating have had much less maintenance work done than pipelines, say, of the 1960s, which used a different type of coating, a tape coating. So we know, based on that and all of our inspections we talked about earlier, that overall pipeline Line 5 and those pipelines are fit for service or are healthy. They're still operational. But what we've seen in a couple of places under the Straits of Mackinac is, if you could imagine, visualize this, you've got the steel pipe. On the outside of the pipe now, you have a coating that was applied again at the steel mill. And then on the outside of that coating is another wrap. The wrap was applied during transportation and installation of the line. And it's done for a lot of reasons. One is, you know, to protect the actual coating from getting any sort of blemishes on it during, you know, transport or the installation. But the other reason is, and this is what I've been told, my understanding is that actual coal tar, when it's first applied, would be quite sticky or gooey, right? So this envelops it or protects it. So what we've seen now in the Straits with all of our inspections, such as the dive teams and the underwater vehicles I've mentioned, are a couple of places where that wrap on the outside has come off. But the actual coal tar coating that sits underneath the wrap, and that's what protects the steel, we have not seen any indication where that has been compromised. And so, you know, from a pipeline integrity perspective, you know, we are being told that the coating is still doing its job, which is to protect the steel. But, you know, we are going to go down into the Straits again this year, this summer, when conditions allow, to look at all of the places where that outside wrap, if you will, has fallen off and do more tests to make sure that while the line has been safe and operational, it continues to be that way going forward. So what you're seeing is really just another ongoing test, one more layer of those testing procedures that would indicate its health going forward.
I spoke with a diver a couple weeks ago who said he went down to the Straits of Mackinac, looked at the Enbridge pipeline, and that there are places on the pipeline where it's actually suspended in air, that it crosses a gully or something, and so that the pipeline is not resting on the lake bottom the entire way. He could have actually swam underneath the pipeline. Are you familiar with this?
I can tell you when the line was originally laid, all right, it followed the contour of the lake bottom. So there's incline, there's decline, it follows the natural lake bottom. In areas where the lake bottom is rocky, it hasn't changed, right? There's no sediment moving because currents won't move the rock. However, there are locations where it's a softer, sandier bottom. And that's where, as you know, currents over time can wash away the sediments. And maybe a span that was very short or an area where it was sitting on the lake bed bottom has been washed away over time. That's why we go down with our divers and inspect again, because one of the things they're looking at are those span measurements, the distance of being unsupported, and also the gap, if you want to call it that, between the actual pipeline and the lake bed. And it's when we find areas that are growing or getting close to exceeding our agreement with the state of Michigan per our easement that we have to file for a permit application with our anchor supports. And so just a quick snapshot, we started doing those anchor supports back in 2002. In 2000, it would have been 2014, we added 24 supports, and then last year we added 4 more. So we have upwards of 120, 130 supports over its history. And this year we will be hoping to add more. But what that does is that assures the line stays relatively stationary so that the currents don't impact the integrity of the line by potentially swaying it back and forth where the sediments would wash away.
Okay, so you guys are accommodating for Absolutely. The fact that there would be some going.
Now you said you can get a variance, I guess, where it exceeds the 75-foot length of unsupported pipe. How many variances are there above 75 feet where you've had to go and get a permit from the state to sort of step outside that original easement?
So through the original engineering analysis, the line was determined to be safe for up to 140 feet. But obviously when we were working with the state of Michigan back in the 1950s, we all agreed we didn't want it to get to that point before we'd install a support. So what we agreed upon back then was this range of 75 feet. Historically, what Enbridge has done is, every other summer when we send down vehicles and divers, we take the measurements. If and when we see a span that hits that 75-foot marker better, we file for a permit application, go in late summer, add the anchor to keep us in compliance. However, what we started to do just last year in 2016, which is our most recent dive, is looking at spans that are not past the 75-foot threshold, but maybe have grown over the 2 years. And so, we're looking at permit applications now to get some of those growing spans even before they get to 75 feet, which again is a far shorter span than the safety threshold of 140. So how many of those have been over 75 feet out of every single anchor we've put in, I'm not sure. But that's where we are right now today. The 4 that we did last fall in 2016 had just exceeded that 75-foot mark. I think the longest span of the 4 was 78, so just over. But the ones we're looking at doing again going forward are more proactive, and a goal is to catch them again before they hit that 75-foot threshold.
I spoke with a senator a couple weeks ago. He said he's concerned that with these spans that have been created that a ship could drop anchor at some point in an emergency situation, catch on these pipelines since they're suspended, and yank the pipeline apart. Is that something that you guys considered as a doomsday kind of scenario?
Well, when you practice any sort of an emergency spill response, you always do what you would call worst case scenario. What truly is the worst case, and that quite frankly is if the line was essentially split wide open, and you know we have twin lines there, so what would indicate that? And you know, an anchor strike is always a concern, but again, it's a minimal concern, and here's why. First of all, on either shoreline, where the water is the most shallow, it's actually buried under the ground to help prevent for anchor strikes. So it's not until your water depth gets to around 60 to 65 feet where then the line is exposed on the lake bottom and follows the contour. One of the reasons it's engineered that way is, again, to protect from anchor strikes. Also, it's important to note that you know, the depth of the water, an anchor would not hit unless for some strange reason the anchor wasn't attached to the ship any longer. And also, this is a no anchor zone, so it's clearly marked with the U.S. Coast Guard as no anchor zone. There are signs and imagery for the freighter traffic that goes through. And based on our integrity data, there's no indication ever of an anchor strike.
Under the best of terms, how long is this pipeline? Can it last forever? I mean, people suggest that the Mackinac Bridge, if it's properly maintained, will last forever. Are you making the same argument for this pipeline?
You know, there is not an expiration date on a pipeline, and I know a lot of people wish you could stamp one on there, but quite simply, there isn't. Not all pipelines are created equal. If you look at the case of the Kalamazoo River, you know, that pipeline was late 1960s vintage, but we've replaced it in its entirety. And the reason why, we had to increase the volume of the product into the line because refiners needed more heavy crude, but it's also because of the amount of maintenance work and integrity work we are doing in that pipeline to keep it safe. I mean, it just wasn't holding up over the years as well as, say, a Line 5. And a lot of that, again, is due to the coating. So pipelines will age and hold up differently. Like I said, the pipelines of the 1950s, which is, again, the era that Line 5 was built, has held up extraordinarily well. That's not to say it would last forever. You know, we don't know. That's why you continue to run the myriad of tests that you do and lay the data on top of the historical or archive data, so you can start to watch even the slightest of changes in that line and its behavior over time.
So you couldn't say that this line should be replaced in 50 years or 100 years. You don't have anything like that. It's more of a real-time kind of analysis of how the pipe is holding up.
Correct. Every pipeline that's operational has criteria, integrity and criteria, operational criteria that it has to maintain to be safe and operational. It's when you start to see from your own inspection data that changes are occurring that start to get you outside of those parameters, outside of the norm, when you have to look at, is it best now to repair? Is it best to replace segments? Or in the case of, say, our Line 6B here downstate, is it best to replace it in its entirety? So with Line 5, again, with all of the inspections that we do, we're not seeing any indication in 2017 to say that line should be replaced or replaced soon. But again, we're keeping the watchful eye on it, so if and when that day comes, we will be prepared to take that next step.
Jason Mansham, he's a community engagement strategist with Enbridge, and congratulations, this has been officially the longest podcast interview in MERS history, but very good information. We wouldn't have been long had we not had a lot of questions, and we appreciate you being dutiful in responding to all of them.
Well, again, thank you for that honor of being the longest, and also just thank you for having me again today. We're always happy to answer questions, so thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Now, to close out, in honor of the Nestle water expansion effort, we are going to do something that Jack has called the Nestle Challenge. I'm very excited about this. Jacob, I'm going to let you take control of this.
Well, and you guys may need to help me out, but I think we were debating earlier this morning the taste between bottled water and tap water. And I think there was a a disagreement between them. And so, Kyle, what is your position or hypothesis going into this?
Well, there's no question that Ice Mountain tastes better than municipal water. So what we have here is you went downstairs and got some Nestle water that I brought into the office today, put one of them in one mug and regular tap water in the other. I'm going to taste the two and tell you which one is which, and then everyone else is going to taste, and we're going to see if we're going to see who's right and who's wrong, and maybe I'm going to be made the fool here. I don't know. This you did this separate, so I don't know. So I'm going to go ahead and taste them. Okay, I know the difference.
Kyle, in case you couldn't hear the gap, that was Kyle drinking the water. I'm not sure if you heard the gulping.
Oh my gosh, did you really hear that? Was that
tell,
actually?
Tell us about the notes that were on your palate.
We are now...
notes?
And what we weren't discussing earlier, apparently we are now going to all drink from the same cups here as one MERS family. I thought this was just you, Kyle.
This is going to be like Thanksgiving dinner here.
I'm not going to taste them because only I know the difference between the cups right now.
Well, you know what water you put into which.
Yes.
I feel like we're in an Agatha Christie novel.
What, if we all fall
You're
over
bring death? Bring forward these proceedings? No, only I know the truth.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah, I hope I didn't pick up anything.
We're all
going to be sick together.
Now Mike is tasting them. If I knew all of us were tasting the cups, I would have filled them up more. I thought only you were drinking them.
I hope there's still some left in there.
We just need Simon to test it out. Okay. So Simon's going to be our last drinker of the water.
Simon's actually smelling
them. Simon's smelling them like he's sampling wine.
Taking a cue from Mike.
Did you smell it too? Oh my gosh. I hope that there's no smelling.
At least half our listeners have probably queued out at this point. Hold on. So we're about to release our results.
We want to... Michigan State Cup.
I think the Michigan State Cup is the tap water.
I can actually tell no difference whatsoever.
Jack still can't tell a difference.
I was surprised I could actually tell a difference in the taste, and I would agree that the white mug there is going to be the tap water.
I thought it was the other way. I thought our blue mug was the tap water.
The results are in. Most of you are wrong. The Ice Mountain water went into the white Michigan State Cup.
No!
Simon was correct.
And it's funny, because I never drink bottled water, ever. I'm a tap water devotee, so I know what I'm tasting.
Unless
you can start saving money, get rid of the plastic buckets, and start...
Unless I am getting beyond my ears and forgetting as I come up the stairs, but I put the Ice Mountain water into the white Michigan State Cup, which now most of the staff has said is the tap water. Can we get some thought? How do you know what tap water tastes like compared to the Ice Mountain?
Well, obviously, I don't know the difference.
I have to say, Jacob, that I feel pretty vindicated. I'm a devotee of boredom water and light tap water. I'm a big advocate of reusable water bottles because they save you a lot of money. And so this is a very affirming experience for me.
I will, having been maybe shown to possibly have been right in my assessment, I will give you this. Maybe if we continue to do these tests, we should do it like wine, where you actually don't swallow it and you do the whole palate thing. If we really want to move forward and do this, so I'll concede that this wasn't the exact way to compare the
two. There's always room for improvement. We're not sure if the water temperatures were 100% the same, so that could be another factor. And should we any last closing comments, Kyle? I think we've going on long enough here.
His grocery bill just went down.
That big Ice Mountain jug that's been in the refrigerator since you all started may slowly just be phased out after we're done with this.
But by the way, a victory for environmentalists everywhere.
For Lansing
is our Jack, are you saying that our water test is going to show up in a press release in coming weeks?
Well, it could. About the same time Cindy Gamrat gets her book deal.
Oh, jeez. Nice. All right, we'll close on that. Until next week, thanks to the gang here. We'll take care.